Chapter 4, Saturday Night Live, The Drug Part. Actually, now that I look at the show schedule, it was certainly no busier than being in the Senate. As at SNL, we senators get recesses, but Senate recesses aren't really breaks. They're just periods of time where we're doing different kinds of work, like traveling around our states, meeting with people, or raising money, or going overseas on the jam-packed congressional trips known as CODELs, or congressional delegations. Either way, senators certainly do a lot less drugs than we did at SNL, unless I'm just completely clueless. As SNL became a cultural sensation, it began to leak out that some of the cast and writers at the show were smoking dope and snorting cocaine. At first, there was some official denial. "You can't do a 90-minute live comedy show week after week and do cocaine," we'd say, and it sounded convincing, at least for a while. The truth is that many on the show thought that you can't do a 90-minute live comedy show week after week without doing cocaine, which, of course, is folderol. Until John Belushi's death, we at SNL didn't really understand that drugs can kill you. But by the time Chris Farley got in trouble, we at the show understood all too well. A couple years after John was found dead of an overdose at the Chateau Marmont Hotel in Hollywood, Bob Woodward of the Washington Post and of Woodward and Bernstein fame wrote a book called Wired, The Short Life and Fast Times of John Belushi. During his research phase, I had agreed to be interviewed by Woodward, but I didn't like the tone of his questions, which seemed to be only about drug use. So I told him that the only time I had seen John snort coke was with Carl Bernstein, which wasn't true, but it cut the interview short. When Wired came out, we all hated it. Not because it chronicled John's drug abuse, but because that was more or less all that it covered. Tom said it was like if someone titled your college yearbook Puked, and all it talked about was who puked, and when they puked, and what they puked. No one read Dickens for the first time, no one learned chemistry, no one fell in love, everyone just puked. The book made no attempt to capture why John was so funny, what his influence was as an improvisational comedian, and how magnetic he was as a person and a performer. Woodward, who has, of course, written authoritatively about Washington, seemed obstinately tone-deaf to the world he was writing about. Lauren said it was as if Woodward wrote a book about rock and roll and referred to the Beatles, a popular British band of the 60s. There was no one who knew Chris Farley who didn't love him. In no small part, that was because Chris was not just an extraordinarily committed, explosively hilarious performer, but also such a genuine fan of everybody else's work. Chris struggled mightily with his addiction. He must have gone to a dozen rehabs, but ultimately he couldn't beat it. After Chris returned to the show from yet another stint at rehab, I created a character for him called the Relapse Guy. The sketch started with the exit session at the rehab before a patient goes home. Tim Meadows, the counselor, would assure the family, Phil Hartman, Julia Sweeney, Mike Myers, and guest host Shannon Doherty, that this time Chris had finally gotten it, which they would clearly not be buying. Tim told them that the rehab had gotten Chris a job as an organ courier. Cut to the operating room where the doctor and his transplant team are waiting impatiently for the liver, which is hours late. Enter Chris, drunk out of his mind. He opens the cooler, pulling out a prepackaged calf's liver from a supermarket meat case and hands it to the doctor before he passes out, collapsing on the patient on the operating table. Chris loved it. Every few weeks he would ask me, "How about another relapse guy?" That was Chris, and really that's dark comedy. A guy who couldn't get clean doing a sketch about a guy who couldn't get clean. And we probably all found it funnier precisely because so many of us had seen the damage addiction can do, not just when it costs people their lives, but it destroys their careers and hurts the ones they care about most. For my part, I never really got into trouble with drugs. I used to say I only did cocaine so I could stay up late enough to make sure that nobody else did too much cocaine, which was a joke, but not too far from the truth. For whatever reason, I never became addicted. There, but for the grace of God, go I. But the thing about addiction is you don't have to be the addict to be affected. And my life has been profoundly affected by substance abuse because two of the most important people in my life struggled with addiction. But it took me a long time to realize that. I grew up in a household that consumed very little alcohol. My first drink came during my freshman year in college when my roommate Dave Griffin and I split a fifth of scotch and got stupid drunk and threw up a great deal. So I was pretty clueless about what was going on when Franken and Davis would go on the road, and Tom would always want to go to a bar before the gig. I'd sit with him going over our act thinking, I wonder what Tom sees in this place. It's so boring. Why in the world does Tom like going to bars? We had a lot of time to spend on the road after 1980 when we followed Lorne out the door at SNL. We went back to doing our act, including a Franken and Davis special for Showtime, writing some TV and some screenplays and playing baggage handlers and trading places. Tom got high more and more, but he was still my partner and my best friend. When Franken and I had a daughter, we named her Thomason Davis Franken. Then in 1985, Lorne came back to the show. He brought me and Tom back, along with a few other Lorne Again writers. Lorne asked the two of us to produce a show, and we jumped at the opportunity. But Lorne, on a youth kick, hired a group of talented but very young cast members like the 20-year-old Robert Downey Jr. and the 17-year-old Anthony Michael Hall, who were not suited to the kinds of sketches SNL had done before. You know, sketches where cast members play adults. The reviews were scathing. Since 1976, year two of SNL, we had all lived with Saturday Night Dead reviews, but that season we deserved it. With Tom routinely disappearing and me presiding over endless rewrite sessions and trying to hold the show together, I felt overwhelmed. Meanwhile, at home, after more than a decade of happy marriage, Franny and I were having trouble. After our second child, Joe, was born, Franny fell into a postpartum depression, which she secretly medicated with alcohol. Something was wrong, but I didn't know what. After the disastrous 1985-86 season, Tom and I decided to leave the show again. We'd go back to doing our act and working on screenplays, but in September of 1986, Franny's drinking just became too much. She had been going through her own kind of hell, trying as hard as she could to both be a good mother and keep her drinking problem a secret, and thank God she went to rehab. Taking care of a 5-year-old Thomason and an almost 2-year-old Joe, I needed a steady job in New York, so I asked Lorne if I could come back to the show, and he, of course, said yes. After getting Thomason off to school and Joe off to daycare, I'd arrive at 30 Rock about 10 hours before the other writers, with the exception of Bonnie and Terry Turner, a husband and wife team from Atlanta who had a daughter Thomason's age. Tom had decided to take a break from the show, so when he'd find time, we'd get together to work on our screenplay. I'd write during the day, pick the kids up, make them dinner, tuck them into bed, and leaving them with a sitter, go back to SNL. That's when I started going to Al-Anon, a 12-step program for family members and friends of alcoholics based on the principles of AA. Like AA, Al-Anon isn't for everybody, but once I started, it didn't take long for me to realize a few important things. For one thing, I finally realized that Franny wasn't the only addict in my life. My best friend since high school and writing partner for nearly 20 years was addicted to alcohol, to cocaine, to pretty much anything that came his way. But I also realized something about myself, that my reaction to Franny's and Tom's addictive behavior had made me a much less pleasant person to be around. As in AA, the fourth step in Al-Anon is to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. The fifth step is to admit to God, or your concept of God, to yourself, and to another human being, the exact nature of your wrongs. That's to another human being and not to everyone who listens to this book. But I will say that I had developed a tendency to lose my temper, be judgmental, and roll my eyes when I thought someone said something stupid. In other words, at times I could be a bit of a jerk. I also discovered how much I could learn from listening to other people's stories, even people who at first blush didn't seem like the kind of people you could learn much of anything from. Thus, the birth of Stuart Smalley, the healing nurturer and member of several 12-step programs who hosted daily affirmations on SNL. Stuart became my most popular character on the show. Guess who hated Stuart? Tom. We still wrote together, sometimes, but he was becoming less and less of a presence on the show. One late Friday night, Tom came into the office and strolled past the big rewrite table where Jim Downey and I and a couple of other writers were trying to come up with a cold opening for the next night's show. "What are you working on?" asked Tom. Downey said, "Saturday Night Live." By 1991, Tom and I were still Frank and Davis, at least in theory. But while Franny was doing great in recovery, Tom was screwing up and in big trouble. So I organized an intervention. In an intervention, you usually present the alcoholic addict with some consequences if he/she refuses to go for treatment. It was hard to do. Tom had been my best friend since high school. I named my daughter after him. And despite the tension between us, I still thought he was the funniest guy I knew. Certainly in my mind, the funnier half of Franklin and Davis. But I told him during the intervention that if he didn't go to rehab, we'd no longer be a team. It didn't work. It was a sad day. It was the end of our partnership and, at least for a few years, our friendship. And as is the case so often with addiction, things got weird. After the intervention, Tom found a guy who threatened to sue me if I didn't split the income I'd made from projects I'd done without him. I tried to reason with Tom, but he refused even to speak with me. But Tom and I had forgotten that, well before the intervention, we had agreed to be alumni of the year for Blake. For a host of reasons, it was something we couldn't not do. So Tom and I found ourselves at our old campus, arguing in the wings of the auditorium about the threatened lawsuit as Mr. Fecht explained to the K-6 graders, "Al and Tom were two boys who went to school here, and they had a dream. That dream was to be on TV, and they worked very, very hard, and the dream came true." Addiction can take an unimaginable toll on the people who love addicts. And that's true even when the addicts in question find recovery. When Franny came back from rehab, things were still difficult. It turned out that early recovery can be hard on everyone. That experience became the basis for the 1994 movie When a Man Loves a Woman, which I wrote with my friend and Oscar winner Ron Bass. The movie, which starred Andy Garcia and Meg Ryan, has a happy and, I like to think, moving ending. And, of course, Franny and I had a happy ending, too. We're still married. We never argue about anything ever. And the higher power removed all my character defects, making me the most well-adjusted senator in the history of the body. Oh, and the movie made money for the studio. Ron and I each got a fruit basket after the opening weekend. The next summer, I shot a Stuart Smalley movie that I'd written and was starring in, with Harold Ramis directing. Harold, who died in 2014, had been a friend since 1974 and was one of the comedy giants of our generation. Stuart Saves His Family, however, was by far Harold's least successful film, dying a terrible death at the box office. No fruit basket. In the end, Tom never actually sued me. We reconciled a few years later, and he asked me to be the best man at his wedding. We remained extremely close, reuniting for special performances and for frequent appearances on my radio show and sharing our devotion to the Grateful Dead and the inevitable disappointments from our beloved Minnesota Vikings. In 2009, Tom was diagnosed with cancer and given 6 months to a year. He lived 3 years with courage, grace, and humor, a gift to me and all who knew and loved him. I visited Tom a few days before he died at the house we once shared in upstate New York. Dan Aykroyd and his wife Donna came that day as well, and we laughed about how Tom had lain behind the counter during the Julia Child sketch, controlling the pressure on the spurting blood by working an insecticide sprayer that sent the dark red liquid through plastic tubing that ran up Danny's leg, through his sleeve, ending at his wrist. It was a special effect which technically is supposed to be performed by a union guy on the crew, but the crew loved Tom, and besides, he knew the bit, and he and Danny worked it to perfection live on air. Tom's humor was always sardonic. As you can imagine, it was even more sardonic that day. He was ready to go. The last few months hadn't been a lot of fun, but he told me he did enjoy crushing up the Dilaudid pills he'd been prescribed and snorting them. I told Tom that the way he was making his exit was an inspiration to me. He said, "I hope you go a little faster." When Tom died, I called his mom, Jean, who recalled how much she loved hearing us laugh from their basement. A tremendous outpouring of love and affection for Tom flowed in from all over the country. It was wonderful to read people's memories of their favorite lines or sketches. Clearly, Tom had touched people's lives, or at least made them laugh. I spoke on the Senate floor about Tom a couple days later. I'm a crier, so I practiced the speech aloud about 40 times so I could make it through. I held it together until rest in peace. The next day, I was sitting in a Judiciary Committee hearing when a staffer slipped me a note. "Leader Reed is on the phone for you." It was unusual for the majority leader to call me in the middle of a hearing. I got up, went to the ante room, and picked up the phone. "Harry?" "Al, I read your eulogy to your friend. He was quite a guy." "Yes, sir, he was." "I love this part, the dark side of death." I smiled. Then Harry read a passage from a piece Tom had written about dying. "In the foreseeable future, I will be a dead person. I want to remind you that dead people are people, too. There are good dead people and bad dead people. Some of my best friends are dead people. Dead people have fought in every war." Then Harry said, "It's perfect." "Yes," I said. "Perfect."